This is Gaia McGahee. I'm here with Claire Cote and Olivia June. Olivia is 3 months old. You might hear some baby sounds in the recording. Today is May 31st, 2018, and I'm interviewing for the first time Flavio Cisneros. This interview is taking place in Flavio's home. It's number 1 Cisco Road, Cuesta, New Mexico. And this interview is sponsored by Leap. Leap is land experience and art of place. It's part of the Cuesta Stories Community Memory Project. So we'll begin.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's a pleasure having you here. I am Flavio Cisneros. I have a middle name, but it's never used unless I sign a legal document. I was born in this, what would I call it, this neighborhood in 1941 as a war baby, August 1941, and to Francisco Antonio Cisneros and Corina Gonzalez Cisneros. There's 10 of us, 11 of us in the family. One was a disease, was born, one of the children was stillborn, but there was 10 of us all together, and 8 boys and 2 girls, and I'm number 8 in the family. So I'm number 7 of the boys.
Wow.
Number 7 of the boys. And so it's been a beautiful life. I'm 77 years old now, and somehow, at this point in my life, memories come flooding back about things your parents told you, and that's why this thing becomes a little more meaningful, I guess is the word that I want to use, a little more meaningful. My sister often tells me that I live in the past. I say, no, I treasure the past because it was a good life. My father was a farmer, and so we grew up with the idea that we had to work in order, not necessarily to earn our keep, but we had to work. And so my father had 30 some acres of land. We had animals, cows and sheep and pigs, chickens. My mother sold eggs to make ends meet. We made cheese and sold, you know, from the milk. We had a dairy cow, so she made cheese and butter and milk, and we sold it. But we never went hungry. In reading, I grew up and eventually became a teacher. And in reading the history of New Mexico, you hear that Taos County was one of the most depressed in the state. And I say, you know what? We never went hungry. I didn't feel like this family was depressed. And I guess it's because my father planted wheat, grains for bread, and we had meat, and we had eggs, we had milk, and so it was. I never experienced any shortcomings, if you will, or starvation, to coin that phrase. No, we had a good life, but it was a working life. Getting up sometimes, to help my father irrigate. I was one of those that didn't do that. My other brothers did. I was never gotten up at midnight to go change the water in the fields. But I remember the harvest when the wheat was cut and when the alfalfa fields were cut also. The baling, I remember the threshing machine coming in. I remember butchering time. When as you're growing up, I guess, these things are, it's so hard, I don't want to do this. But as you grow older, you look back with a lot of fun memories and you say, you know what? They were actually enjoyable times. I remember shaving the pig after it was slaughtered, because you had to take the hair off, So I remember when they boiled the water in barrels or whatever the container they had, and then they would put a place a gunny sack or some kind of cloth over the pig and then pour the water so they would loosen the hair and then shave it or yank it off. So yeah, I remember those things. I remember one of the neighbors sometimes, you know, they would, because the whole neighborhood would gather during slaughtering time. And there was always a piece of meat to go for those people who came in to help out. And so it was a good time. I remember them throwing the kidneys in the fire and they would take them out and then eat them from there. They were cooked already, but sometimes you would see the ashes and the soot around somebody's face where they had eaten the kidneys or whatever they threw in the fire. Everything was saved. We lost nothing. We lost nothing.
What season is that? What time of year was that?
Oh, that was I guess in the fall, you know, when we did that. Spring was planting and fall was the harvest, but I remember, it was like yesterday. Sometimes you look back and you say, God, I remember those things very vividly. And right here where this house is, this is where the shaving of the pig or the slaughtering of the pigs took place, right on below this house. There's a story about my uncle, my godfather. So he would come and help and he would not think of pouring the hot water over the animal, over the pig to shave him. What he did, he must have been a strong man. I cannot see anybody picking up a pig and bathing him in the tank of water, but that's what he did once, and you know, everybody was astounded that he would do that, but it must have helped. That must have done the trick. My mother and all the women cooked for the men, but I remember blood pudding. You know, they fried the blood with a lot of oregano and onion, and it was a delicacy. I don't know that I could eat it now, but at that time it was a delicacy. Mm-hmm. To save the intestines, you know, and we would clean them completely. We always have water running. There's a ditch that right on the other side of this house, and the water seemed to be running all the time. So they would take this intestines, you know, and they would open them, and then they would float down. You would hold them, but they would float down the ditch, you know, and the water mm-hmm. would pass through them, and that's how you cleaned them. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And yeah, how long were they? How long was that?
Oh my God, I don't know. It must have been at least maybe 4 or 5 feet long, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, and then they would take those either from the sheep or the pigs. They would take them, wrap them around a piece of fat, and put them in the oven, and that's how they would. How they would cook them, so they wouldn't be dry. Yeah. When the grain was harvested, they would throw. My dad would take part of that grain to the mill in San Luis, and they would grind it there, and he would bring it back, and that was the flour that my mom used for making bread and tortillas.
But the grain was all grown here.
Yeah, the grain was all grown here. Yeah, and on this land, and. My mother oftentimes would throw a sack of wheat into the ditch, and it would sprout, and then the water of course was clean in those days. I don't think you would do that today, but it was clean in those days. And then they would, after the wheat had sprouted, she would take it and spread it and dry it, and then they would take that wheat also and grind it, and that's how they had sprouted wheat. You know, flour, mm-hmm. you know, whole wheat flour. So those things were interesting. And of course, that sprouted wheat was used for making what they call panocha today. And you don't have to taste it. It was one of those foods, I think, you know, that people have lost touch with.
Yeah, what is it? Can you describe it?
It's, you caramelize the sugar, and then you pour it into this flour, and then you cook it for hours. Okay, bake it, actually. You bake it for hours, and you add, maybe you add vanilla or something to it, but there's some in the fridge. I'll let you taste it, okay? So
so it's that, like a pudding.
It's like a pudding, mm-hmm. Yes. Uh-huh.
Panocha.
Whole wheat, panocha. My mother always said that it was such an ugly name.
What does it mean?
I have no idea. I have no idea why they would name it that, and I don't even know what that word means. But today, when you mention the name, you know, when you, it, everybody knows what it is. Okay, it's a reference to that wheat pudding. So, yeah.
I have a question about food storage, like the food, the meat, and that, those sorts of items that have to be preserved. There are some structures around, and I think it was Carrie or someone was talking about dispensas.
Oh,
places
yes,
where things are stored.
Yeah, it was like a shed right here where this house next, you know, and right by this tree right here, mm-hmm. We used to have a dispensa, okay? A shed. It was a log structure. And when the pigs were slaughtered, some of the meat was cured, and I remember my mom said they always had it hanging there, and they would make ham, right? The curing salts for ham, and then of course, the it was cool, and so you know the meat always hung there. It never spoiled or anything.
Is it dug into the earth?
No, it was just hanging from the beams.
But I mean, the foundation. It's not. How come? Why did the building stay cool? How did it stay cool?
In this respect, probably because he was under the tree, mm-hmm. Okay, and I really don't know. Next to it, we used to have, next to the dispenser, we used to have an ice shed, okay, that we used to store the ice for. And we always stored the ice for this thing, okay. This was my mom's old icebox.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
right there next to you.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I refinished it, and this is the cube for the ice, see? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So it's like an insulated wooden
cabinet. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So we always had ice in that ice house. Done. And the preservation, and of course we always had a cellar. And that, of course, that was underground, right? Mm-hmm. We always had a cellar next to the house, and we always stored our potatoes and our pumpkins, and my mother canned a lot. Of course, you know, she needed to in order to have, you know, to feed 8 or 10 mouths. In reference to that, my dad used to say sometimes, in saying, I guess, or in referring to that we ate a lot, he'd say that he was going to grind deer horn so that we would eat and feed it to us so we wouldn't eat so much. And I always wonder what the heck deer horn would do, you know, if you ingested it. I don't know, maybe it settled in your stomach and fill you up. But he always said, he always, in Spanish, he'd say, voy a moler cuerno de venado. So, para que no coman tanto, you know, grind the deer horn so you won't eat so much. Mm. So, yeah, no, but my mother always canned, and so that cellar was always full. Fruit and vegetables, you know, they were, you know, since they were seasonal, and we didn't have peach trees around here, so we always looked forward for people to bring in, you know, some of the fruit from out of town, mm-hmm. And that one was, you know, you safeguarded that fruit. You wouldn't let anybody eat it. You could eat, well, you know, when the seller came, but after that, it was hands off because it all went into the jars, mm-hmm. to for winter. So we had potatoes and we had pumpkins. We had jars, and my dad bought my mom a canner one time, and she hated it. She hated it because I don't know why, but I remember that canner, you know, and so they would have to buy the tin cans in order to be able to can them. She didn't like it. She did not like it.
So she used glass jars.
She used glass jars, yeah. With the ones with the rubber gaskets on them. There was no Kerr Mason lids that, you know. And so, anyway, so she used those jars. My dad, you know, my dad was a go-getter, and he always tried to bring to provide for my mom things that would make her life easier than, you know. And so I remember that canner he brought, because we had dairy cow, or because we had milk, he bought a separator so that you would put the milk in there, separate the cream from the milk, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And he bought her all kinds of nice things, you know, that would make life easier for her. I think we were one of the first families in Cuesta to get electricity. Oh. Yeah, so that was 1940 something, I think.
Seven. Just read it last night.
Yeah, because I remember doing homework with the kerosene lamp. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
So you were six when the electricity came?
Yeah, huh? Yeah. We had two nice lamps that burned gas, the white gas. In fact, I have one lamp there, okay, that I hogged, and I say, no, that's my going back in time souvenir. It's right there. Mm-hmm. I'll show it to you in a little while. So yeah, we had one, and it hung from the beam in the kitchen, you know. It always hung there. And but every evening I remember my mom and my dad, you know, pumping air into the receptacle, and then those wicks would light up very, very nicely, and of course the light was brighter. So no, but we always did homework. Always did homework with under lamplight. I don't remember candles, but the lamps, the kerosene lamps, I remember. I remember going to the store to get kerosene when they say, okay, take the little oil container and go get some from the store, and you'd fill up the whole, you know, this little container, metal container that had a spout in it. You'd 5 cents, 10 cents for a container full of kerosene. So,
and what store would you go to for that?
The closest across, if you went across the fence, across all the fields, the one, the guy who sold oil was Miguel Velasquez right here, and he had a container in his store from where he pumped the kerosene for you.
What road was that store on?
You know, as you come up the hill, the Cabresto, the Cabresto hill, right. Let's see. Oh Lord, which house is it? Not the first, the second house. And on your left, that's where the store used to be. Mm. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, the Velasquez store. Yeah, that's where we used to get it. Yeah. So.
Did he sell other things? Or
yeah, he's, you know, I mean, there was there was grocery stores. There was one, there was about four or five, maybe even six stores, you know, that sold, you know, limited items, you know. Miguel Velasquez was one of those. I remember him. I remember the... What we used to go to that store for was sen-sen, is what we called it. It's an aromatic candy. It tastes like, what does it taste like? But I remember going there. We wanted sen-sen, it was what we called it, and that's where we got it. So
sen-sen, like, how would you spell that?
Like C-E-N-C-E-N. It was like a little, it was a little gray candy. Gray candy, yes.
Uh-huh. And it just had a particular flavor.
It had a particular flavor, and I don't know that you could find it anywhere. It was not licorice, but, you know, it could maybe have had a slight taste of licorice, but...
Anise?
No, you know what? I really don't... Yeah. You know, to come to think of it, I don't know what you would call it in English. Mm. Yeah.
What would you call them in Spanish?
That was what we referred to, you know, just called sen-sen, you know, sen-sen. So that was
So I have a question about your I know you spend a lot of time cooking or preparing foods and drying plums and making the prune pies or drying them and making the prunes. I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit about cooking. I'm curious because you're talking about your mom, if any of that history, like if you started cooking when you were young or if you revisited cooking later, or how has cooking entered into your life besides this interest in?
Well, you know, I remember the prune pies especially and the empanaditas. Those were only Christmas items. You never ate those things except at Christmas, at least in my house anyway. Okay? And so remember gathering around the table where my mother, you know, we used to have a round table like this. I remember gathering around the table and watching my mom doing this, but it never occurred to me how she did it, okay? It was only after her passing in 79, I'm sorry. After her passing in 1979 that I started remembering some of these things, you know, that she did, and I said, well, my mother never had recipes. You know, it's a pinch of this and a dash of that or what have you. And so, I don't know, maybe my memories, my taste memories were much more vivid than what I thought they would be, you know, but I remember starting to do some of this things, you know, and you'd say, no, it doesn't taste, it's not the same. Something is missing here. It doesn't taste the way my mother used to do it. So that's where all this came back, you know, that I started revisiting what she had done. And so that's how I got involved with the cooking. When I used to cook, when I was in high school, I became a fry. I worked as a fry cook in Red River, washing dishes, and then graduated to the grill. But that was my only experience with cooking. Okay, it was make hamburgers and hot dogs and frying chicken, you know, but never anything from scratch, like you would if you were a regular, you know, regular cook. So, you know, my cooking experience is only recent, and it's only because I wanted to remember what she did. This year, for the first time in my life, I made that panocha. I remembered how it tasted, but I had never tried it. And I kept asking Jeannie Masters. She said, I have a recipe that I'm going to give you. And I said, well, give it to me so that I can learn how to do it. You know, and so she never did, the recipe never came. And I said, you know, there's nothing like, you know, like locking horns with the project. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it. So just from memory, I remember what she did, you know, short of burning the sugar. You know.
Did you sprout the wheat then?
No, they sell the sprouted wheat flour at Super Saver, that Lowe's in Taos, and that's, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same thing, you mm-hmm. know, that we used to have. So that's how I learned how to do it. I made tortillas for the first time 2 years ago also because I said, you know what? I do not like what I find at the store. Mm-hmm. But I find at the store. So how do you solve that problem? You learn from scratch, and you learn by making mistakes. And so that's how I learned. You know, that's how I have learned. Yeah, the prune pies were the easiest part. That was the easiest part for me to learn. I know. I remember drying the plums after we picked them. We always picked the plums on the 15th of September. You know, so we had a tree in the front. There's part of the tree is up in front of the house. This is my mom and dad's house right here. This one. Okay, so anyway, the tree is up front. And I remember picking them on the 15th of September, you know. And then the coal shed, and what became the coal shed after the ice disappeared, you know, it became a coal shed. And that we would spread those plums on top of the roof, and that's where we dried them. We didn't have as many magpies. We didn't have any magpies then that would rob you, you know. Now they do. You know, you put them outside, and they'll take everything they can. But then I mean, you could have them out there for, they probably would dry in like in about 3 weeks. And then you'd take them down, you know, and put them in a sackcloth and hang them in the dispensa from one of the beams. So that's how I got involved with the cooking. Yeah, so amazingly, very few people in my family know how to make those things, you know, that my mother used to make. Mm-hmm. And my mother too, she was, you know, my mother was, she was 12 when she was orphaned, when her mother and father passed away. And so she, cooking for her, I think, you know, I don't know if it was difficult, but she learned out of necessity. Mm-hmm. Out of necessity. She was 18 when she married. She had been kind of, the raising was finished, you know, by her maternal aunt and paternal uncle. And but she, I remember her saying, you know what, I try, she say, I've always struggled with learning, with making apple dumplings. I remember vaguely, she'd say, I remember vaguely my mother doing this, you know. So if she was 12 when she was orphaned, I just wonder, you know, how she could remember some of those things, you know. Mm-hmm. But the mind is a wonderful thing, I think, you know. It brings back a lot, you know, especially when you find yourself in dire straits. So.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that time period when she was orphaned, the cause?
Yeah, my mother's parents had three homes. Aww. If I remember correctly. Aww. They had a home in Cuesta, they had land in Red River that they had, there was a house there, and then there was their other home up in Bobcat, what they call Valle del Oso now, and it must have been a horrible situation, you know, when the flu came in. My mother lost both her father and her mother in 1918 in the month of May. My mother always said the month of May is when she lost her mother and her father. Her mother died up in the mountain. That's where she died, and her father died here in Cuesta. And they were buried in the old cemetery. My mother always said that next to the gate. So many people died then that I don't think that even the graves were marked. So you can only guess approximately where. My mom always said about three or four graves to the right as you enter. And so but I don't know where my grandfather is buried. I don't know if he's in the same vicinity, since so many people, you know, were dying. And she always said, and my father did too, saying, you know, that oftentimes they wondered if the people, some of the people that were not buried alive, because there was a quarantine as well in Cuesta. They had declared it a quarantined area, so very people went out, and they went out only to bury the dead. And some of them probably were just comatose, I would say, you know, when they were buried. So.
And what is the name of that cemetery?
You know what? I have no idea what the name of that cemetery is. I've been wondering what the name was. We just called it the Old Cemetery. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how it's been known in my lifetime.
And that's across
from the parish hall right now. And there is an oratorio within the cemetery that was used by the people, and probably penitentes also, you know. But anyway, the body was taken there prior to internment, and it was laid on this adobe table, and right before the internment. I don't know that there was any coffins, you know, made for the dead people. I know was that the body was laid there prior to the internment. The wakes were always held at the family home. And, you know, I've often wondered, and I never took the time to ask, well, what did you do during the winter? You know, and winters were long and harsh here. But I remember my mom saying, and my dad too, that they would take the bodies over there. So did you do that in winter too? And you know what? They didn't remember that, you know. They remembered when it was nice, you know. I mean, the spring through fall, somebody died. The wake was out. The body was kept outside of the house, so, you know, not inside. I remember going to a wake where the body was outside. I remember going to a wake next door over here to our house where the bodies were inside. But by that time, there was, what is the process we call right now? The
like embalming?
The embalming, you know, by the time that I remember my cousins, you know, laying here for a wake, there was embalming already. But at that time, there was no embalming, and so I'm sure that in order to preserve the body from going bad, that they had to do it, they had to keep the body outside.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so about the oratorio, who told you, or how did you find out, like,
well,
it was a grandparent who was telling you?
Yeah. Well, you know, you always look back and say, okay, My aunt Cornelia was all, you know, she mentioned some of these things to me. My dad could remember a lot. He was an hermano, you know, he was a penitente at some point in his life. But, and my mother would talk about these things also, but I never was astute enough to dig any further, you know. It's only now that you say, your curiosity is aroused and you say, I should have asked, or can I remember a few more things? I don't know, shake your my memory, I can't, you know. And I've asked my brothers who are older than I am, see if they can remember, and they don't remember, you know. So I have to rely on what my parents, you know, my parents told me. Yeah, so, anyway. End of story there.
Okay. Yeah. I have a question. You've mentioned in passing a couple of times your education. What was your experience with school? I know that that's something you value strongly in your life.
I love learning. I went to school here down at Cienega School. I started when I was, was I 6 years old? At that time, we had to go to the pre-first before you went to pre-first when you were six. So by the time you finished school, you were already 19. So I was almost 19 when I finished school, but I went to school here. We were, there were 16 in my graduating class in 1960. And I think school was a lot of fun, to be honest. We were under the county system. And then we were still under the county system when I finished school in 1960. So we had a principal that was appointed by the county, not by a local school board. I think the school board came into existence in Cuesta probably in the 1970s, I think. But I graduated from Cuesta. I went on to Highlands, but I did not like it. I guess I wasn't ready for school when I went, you know, but I came out of there, and then I joined the military. It was in the military that I became much more interested in education, and so I attended the University of Maryland when I was overseas in Germany. And then I came back, and I decided that I wanted to go to school. And so I went to Western New Mexico in Silver City. That's where I graduated from. The one thing that I think kind of held us back here at the school here in Cuesta was the fact that, you know, a lot of the courses that are now common in school were not offered. I took chemistry for the first time, or algebra, when I was a senior. You know, it was introduced for the first time in the schools. And I think it was because of the Sputnik area. That's, you know, that's when it was offered. I remember going one night. We were going to a basketball game, my cousins and I, and we saw this thing of going across the sky. And he started crying because it was something strange that he didn't understand, but it came to find out that it was that, you know, that Russian satellite, you know, that was going across the sky. So, yeah, no, I like I said, I went to school with the University of Maryland and graduated from Western. I got a BA and an MA from Western, majored in education, and came home, not necessarily, didn't come home to teach. I taught school in Taos and then moved up to Cuesta in 1976 because Cuesta paid more than Taos did. So $1,000 more. So I came here. Then in Cuesta, I received a scholarship to go one summer, full paid scholarship to go to Cornell in upstate New York, and another scholarship to go to a university up in northern Pennsylvania, Amish country, and I can't even remember what it's called. It was north, something like Northwestern, but anyway, I went there for one summer also.
So, to Northwestern, or which one did you go to?
I went to Cornell one summer, and then I went to this one in upstate Pennsylvania. It's an Amish country, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name of the university right now. Beautiful school.
Cornell, the Cornell College or Cornell University?
Cornell University. Yeah. Scholarship from the Teamsters. And they paid for everything. They paid for the flight and room and board and books.
What did you study in particular?
Well, my major at the university was history, government, and economics. So, So I taught history in school. And
back here,
yeah. And it's because that I did a lot of my concentration was history after the Civil War, you know. So my concentration was there, and I loved that period of time because it was a time, I think, when the United States started waking up, and I saw also how things, you know, were being done here, and I saw how nationalism worked, and, you know, and it's such a horrible thing, you know. And I remember that in the learning process, and then the experiences that the people here in New Mexico, from visitors from Texas especially, we were brown niggers. So mm-hmm. I say you learn to be defensive. You learn not to accept it, but to overcome some of that nonsense. And so, anyway, that's why I became interested in education and to teach the kids that I had under me the value of education and the value of being able to speak English correctly, because that was the biggest drawback in learning, you know, in speaking English properly. I remember when I enrolled at Western, one of the first things that I had to do was take a speech exam before I was accepted. And so I took the speech exam, and the lady who gave me this the exam said, who administered the exam, and looking back now, it was really not much of an exam. You had to read into a tape recorder, you know, which I did, and she'd say, "Mr. Cisneros, you speak English so well. Where did you learn?" And so, later I find out that Silver City is redneck country, you know, and so every Hispanic that enrolled at Western had to take a speech exam, and mostly everybody had to take speech first year. So, yeah.
Wow. So how many years did you teach history in Cuesta?
I taught in Taos. I started teaching in Taos in 1970, and I moved to Cuesta in 1976. So I was here in Cuesta the fall of 1976, and then from 1976 to 1994, I believe, I taught school in Cuesta, in high school. I taught 3 years at the middle school And the rest of my tenure was at the high school. And I taught American government and American history. New Mexico history I taught at the middle school level, but the other one was American history, government, and world history. And I loved American government. That was, to me, the best class that I could teach. And as part of that, I was able to take to enroll our school in a close-up foundation. And so every year for about 5 or 6 years, I think I took kids to Washington to see how the Congress works. Yeah, spent a week there, so.
I was thinking, so I didn't realize you were here then, during that time, 1976 to 1994. So you talked about your family, you're growing up with your family and your parents, but maybe I didn't realize you'd raised your family here then, during that time, I imagine. But I wonder if you could talk about that period in Cuesta, beyond teaching, but like just the memories of Cuesta in that period.
At that time.
And your own family.
When I left the military, I went to school. I was very close to my mother and father, and so before I was discharged from the service, I called up both my mother and father. I spoke to them about how they felt if I stayed in the military, and my mom and dad felt that maybe I should come home because they had no one to take care of them. My mother said to me, "Who's going to take care of us?" And so I think that was what brought me home. Mm-hmm. So I said, "You know what, Mom?" I said, "You know, I'll come home. But you got to promise me that, you know," and I don't know if that's, you know, stating it correctly. I said, "You know, I need to go to school. I need to go to school. And I'm going to go far enough away from home where I cannot be at home every weekend. Because coming home every weekend to me was symbolic of a failure. Because coming home is too easy and you don't do your homework or whatever. And so I decided Silver City was far enough from home and it was still within the state where I wouldn't have to pay out of state tuition. So anyway, so I went to school there, and then I accepted a job in California. And then I said, who wants to go to California? I don't want to go to California. And then I accepted another, so I turned that one down. Then I accepted a job in Deming, Southern, and I said, and then one day I received a call from the superintendent in Taos, and he said, "Congratulations, how does it feel to be working for Taos?"
How did that happen?
I had my cousin's husband, Norman White, he worked for the Taos system. And do you know Don White? He sometimes plays music over at Cynthia's.
Oh.
And so anyway, Don's father, his wife now was the superintendent's daughter. And so Norman and the superintendent were compadres, if you will. And so he must have told the superintendent something that I was looking for a job. So that's how I came home. He said, "Congratulations, how does it feel to be working for Taos?" And I was aghast, no. So I came home and I lived with my parents, you know, I took care of them, I stayed home, and then I got married in 78. Yeah, 78. And then my mom passed away in 79. So, yeah. But it was still a happy life, though. You know, there's a lot of good memories. I took care of my father after my mother passed away. She passed away in 79, And so my dad kind of gave up after, you know, after my mom's passing, he kind of gave up. So he left me all the cows and all the land to take care of. And I almost found it impossible to, you know, to have a regular job and to, mm-hmm. and to do all this, you know, because my brothers didn't want to help me. So, and so that's how I inherited the cows. Okay.
Did your brothers live here?
My brothers live, we all live like in a kind of compound. I have a brother that lived right there, another brother that lived, two or three brothers that lived right here, and one across the field, and yeah, they all lived within the, you know, within walking distance of the house here. So, so I inherited all that, the work. I inherited the work and the care of my father. Then he passed away in 1989.
Mm. 10 years after your mother.
Ten years after my mom passed away. Yeah, yeah. My mother's passing was especially hard because she developed cirrhosis, and my mother was not a drinker. We associate cirrhosis with alcoholism, but she was, you know, she was not. And the doctor at that time said, you know, that she must have contacted something when she was young. And I think it's probably the flu that had, you know, that had taken her mom and dad, had attacked her, but not enough to, you know, to take her. And so her liver, you know, kept deteriorating over the years. So that's what she passed away from. She was only 72. It was a horrible, to me it was a horrible passing because, So, but this is the family compound and I love it here. Yeah. I love it here. This is my home. I don't know that I could ever leave.
You said that this road that we drove up, Kiowa, it ended here. It was...
Kiowa Road ended right there as you turned into my house. When my father used to tell me, when he bought this piece of land, there was no road here. Mm-hmm. So he bought the entrance to this land, which is when you enter from the Red River Road, when you enter, that road was non-existent. So he bought that piece of land from, you know, Armando, Cynthia's husband.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, his grandmother. So my dad bought that piece of land from Armando's grandmother, from Florinda, and so that we would have an access over here. Otherwise, they would have to go around by Pueblito. And that land right there was swampy. It was very swampy, you know? And so there were times, even after he bought the land, there were times when you couldn't pass. Because of, and it was boggy. So even then, they had to go around. And so they could come down here. So,
what changed it to make it not a boggy, the swamp, La Cienega?
Pouring gravel and pouring more dirt and doing this. Yeah, I remember one Christmas, my sister and I was very close to Josie, my sister, and we wanted to make a fruitcake, but we couldn't afford nuts, pecans. We went to the store, and we bought peanuts. And on the way back, she lived in that by the, she was married and she had children already, and she lived right in that house, that two-story house right there. That was my grandmother's house, and so anyway, so we got stuck in the bog. We couldn't come. Somebody had to go take us, you know, pull us out of the swampy area. So, yeah. He made a fruitcake with peanuts. It didn't taste very good.
Yeah, I've had your fruitcake.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of good memories here. You know,
What do you think about Cuesta today, or some? Because you've been active and working in the community up to the present moment. You know, even I'm thinking of all of the work at the church and the food and coordinating things. Mm. I mean, how do you want to say anything about?
You know, I did not have. I've always felt that Cuesta could be a light to a lot of people if we had a little more pride in how the community looked. And so that's been one of my biggest, you know, problems is accepting what Cuesta looks like, you know, and I would like for people to develop this thing about improving and keeping it, because I remember growing up and looking down from where the church is, you know, down into this valley. It was beautiful, it was lush, it was green, you know, and there was no junk, no trash. People took care of their land and they took pride in keeping their fences up and, you know, and making sure that things looked nice, pristine. It was clean. And now, I think otherwise, okay? I don't want to go into that. I got involved with the church, and after I got involved with the rebuilding of the church, I said it's time to do something here. And that's why I became involved in this QCC, because I want to see things improve. I love the community. I think it has a lot of potential. But I think that the potential can only be realized when people have a common dream.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think then is a barrier or has been the barrier not having that common dream? Or what's been the reason for
that? As much as I understand that people had jobs when this mine opened up and boomed, but I think that people kind of lost their way. People lost their way. I think, you know, they forsook their land and concentrated, you know, on having a job with a mine. The mine became the end all for everything, you know, the answer to everything. And I always resented that, because when I taught school, you know, in encouraging the kids to strive to become, you know, literate and not necessarily smart in that respect, but to become successful, to me, the key to success is education. That's always been my thing. Key to success is education. And you try to push and encourage the kids, you know, to be successful, to be good learners and to rise above. I always had, I'm going to work at the mine anyway, and I'm going to be earning more than you. That was the comeback, and I resented that. I resent that yet, because the mine was not the answer. And I always said, you know, that the mine was not a forever thing. Mm-hmm. That was my argument with the kids. The mine is not a forever thing. One of these days, that mine is going to collapse, and what are you going to do? Because you will not be prepared to accept the challenges that will come from having no mind. Where are you going if you can't read or write? I remember speaking to one of the school board members when he ran for office. I won't mention his name. But he came to my door and he said, you know, he said, I know that you are a champion for education. He said, my big thing, he says, in wanting to serve on the school board, is that we have kids who go and apply for work at the mine. They cannot fill out an application. And to me, that was pitiful. And I think that it is a painful thing to see kids who cannot function, you know? Mm-hmm. Or not literate enough to, you know, what do you do? What do you do if you can't learn to read? I mean, if you haven't been able to read or write? Mm-hmm. Who do you depend on for a livelihood?
Right.
Yeah? To me, that's been a big struggle, and that's what I see in the community, was that the mine was, to me, was not a good thing. It provided jobs, yes, but you know what? It did not bring in all the answers that, you know, that one hopes for. A lot of people sold their water rights to the mine too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But, no, I don't think, you know what, I still resent the mine for that.
In selling the water rights to the mine, did that change then what they could do on our land?
Yes.
Is that the direct relationship?
Yeah. They don't have any, they don't have any water rights, they can't plant.
Uh-huh.
Right? And some people today, I don't know that if you, my argument is, and I may be wrong, but I think that if people are forced to return to the land and they don't have the tools
mm-hmm.
to, you know, and I don't mean mechanical tools. I'm talking about the knowledge to be able to live off the land. It's not there. I don't think it's there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in selling the water, they're not practicing this, the land, the skills,
yeah.
then those are the missing parts.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm a follow-up question on the mine. Have you, what's your experience in the community over the years when the employment has gone up and down? You know, have you noticed differences in the community? I know it's now different because the mine is in the process of shutting down. But what did you notice when those changes happened? Did you notice anything?
It's hard to say, you know, but I think that the work ethic has changed. The work ethic changed much to the detriment of the community, I think, and families. Because now, I don't know if it's diverging from your question, you know, but I, you know, we are so dependent dependent on government help anymore.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, you know, the downfall from this thing, you know. We're so used to earning big bucks that we don't know how to work for less than that. I remember wanting to hire people to come and help us here, you know, because when I inherited the land from my father when he gave up, you know, trying to find people to come and help you. I will go if you pay me $20 an hour.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So the price you could earn at the mine set the bar, or set the price
yeah.
people would expect.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Mm-hmm. But, I think the mine spoiled people, to be honest with you. I went to work when I was 14. I was washing dishes in Red River. I earned $18 a week. Washing dishes. Now you tell me what $18 is. In today's monetary, you know, thing, $18 is what? My God, you can't even buy two hamburgers with $18 anymore, can you?
Yeah.
$18 was a lot for me then, you know, and that's what I worked for, $18 a week. Even when I went in, when I left Cuesta and I enlisted in the military, I was earning $1 an hour. I worked 63 hours a week and I got $63.
What did you do? What was your job in the military?
I was a diesel mechanic,
oh.
of all things. But I was, I don't know what my supervisor saw in me, but anyway, I worked in this shop that had all of this mechanics, and we used to have new airmen. I was in the Air Force. So we had all this airmen coming in, you know, you have this rotation after whatever years, you know, and so I became the instructor for kids, you know, who were new to the organization. I had to make sure that they did their, you know, because they had, when you come out of tech school, you come out with a one level then, okay? So you had to get your three level as soon as you hit your assignment. And so I was responsible to make sure that they could test and get their three level rating or five level. So that's what I did, yeah.
So you were a teacher.
I was a teacher and a clerk. So
and
did a lot of typing.
Mm-hmm.
in those days.
How long were you in the military then?
I was 4 years. I was 4 years. 4 years. 3 years of those in Germany. I loved it. I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to see the world, and I did see, and that's where my love for history, was.
Where in Germany were you stationed?
I was in Eifel region. It's an area right by Holland, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg with Germany, but in the same vicinity. Within 10 miles or within a half hour, you could be in either country. So I was there. I worked at a missile base. We had 16 MACE missiles, and they were all pointed towards the Soviet Union, towards the east, and that was kind of scary. Yeah, I got in trouble in the military. That's why I went. I was shipped to the missile site because I was a real rebel. I've always been a rebel. I do not accept people who give orders for the sake of giving orders. I do not accept it very lightly. So we had this sergeant in my shop where I was teaching the airmen. He said he did not like Ron Schmidt, my friend. He did not like him, and so he wanted him out of the shop, and he didn't know how to do it without sounding impartial. I mean, without sounding like he was prejudiced against him. And so he said his method of trying to get rid of Ronald Schmidt was to put all the names of the airmen in the shop, put them in a hat, and pull out Ronald Schmidt. And so I said, I said, you're a coward. You're a coward, I said, because you know what? You're the supervisor in this section. If you cannot give a direct order, if you cannot say, you're going, you don't deserve to be a supervisor. Then he said, you go too. So I got shipped out. I got shipped out to the missile base. Yeah. To the missile section, I should say. I rebelled. I rebelled against the sergeant teacher. His last name was Teacher. I rebelled against him. I rebelled against the superintendent here too. I accept change, but I think I expect people to be fair, and legitimate. No. So that's why I'm always in trouble. So.
How is it you're always in trouble?
Because I challenge.
Yeah.
I challenge, I got into it with a priest over here one time. He wanted to know everything after the church was built. He wanted to know, well, I guess to make this a little more clear, I had asked to plan a reception for the whole community to celebrate the reconsecration of the church. And so I said I got permission to do it. The church didn't belong to the archdiocese yet. So the reconstruction board said, go ahead, run with it. And so I proceeded to run with it, and then the priest came in, stuck his nose in, and he wanted to know what was going on and who was bringing what and who was doing what. And I said, you need not worry. Everything's being taken care of. I've made sure that we've covered every base. And he still insisted he wanted to know who was going to bring a turkey, who was going to bring a loaf of bread. And I said, it's not important. You're not involved in this, and you don't need to know. People don't want to advertise what it is they're bringing. Because at one point, he wanted me to the list of names of people who were bringing in stuff to the church for the workers to eat. And I said, no. People want to remain, They when they give things, they don't want to be advertised. They want to, they want to give it. If they want to give it with an open heart, and It's not important that people know who brought beans or who brought bread, who brought tortillas or whatever. And so anyway, so he got on my case. He said that he needed to know. And I says, well, I'm not giving you any names. I'm sorry. I am not giving you any names. And he looked at me and he said, the problem with you is you want to do things your way. And I said, yes, I do. I want to do things my way. This is my thing. I've got it all planned. It's all taken care of. You don't need to know anything. So I said, you know what? You're not happy with what I'm doing. Fire me. And he walked away.
He didn't fire you?
He had no reason to fire me. But what idiot was going to volunteer to do what I was doing?
Who would take over your voluntary job?
Yes. You know, we fed 750 that day.
Mm-hmm. You know? Consecration.
Yeah. And it was only because I had planned it. I mean, I had made sure that everything had been taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I worked in school. I made sure that my students knew what was going to happen, when and how and whatever, you know. And mm-hmm. the principal didn't like it. That was too bad, you know.
Yeah.
I told the principal one time. He left me in charge. I was the senior teacher at the school, and so he left me in charge. He was going to leave, go do something. He said, "You're in charge. Take care of the school while I'm gone." And so I was taking care. And then he snuck back into his office, and the kids, you know, some teacher let the kids out, and they were running all over, and he was there. He was in his office, and I just went to him and I said, you know what? You're the principal here. You left me in charge in your absence. You're back here. You get your ass out of there, out of that office. I said, you go take care of your school. I'm not taking care of it for you. Keep your mouth shut. I will. I'm sorry.
I'd heard you were a rebel.
You heard?
I heard.
Yeah, I am. And it's not, I don't rebel for rebellion's sake. I don't, you know. Mm-hmm. If I see that things are not done right, you know, and not necessarily for me,
mm-hmm.
but for everyone concerned, then I will speak up.
Where do you feel that comes from? Where do you identify the source of that sense?
My father, you know, let me tell you, I think it was, I think it was from my mother, to be honest with you. Because my father always said, obey your betters. That didn't sit well with me. Because there is no one better than I am. That was my argument. Everyone is equal. There's no such thing as obey your betters. Do as you're told, was his thing. Do as you're told, obey your betters. And I said, in me, I said, no. Don't do that, you know. And my mom,